The Big Picture, a Christian insight into the world of movies, television and pop culture with magazine editor Ben McKechin and scriptwriter Mark Hadley. A Bible Society Australia production, sharing the light of God's Word into every corner of your world.
Howdy do, I'm Ben McKechin.
And I'm his personal paparazzi, Mark Hadley. Welcome to episode 86 of The Big Picture for the week beginning November 20. And coming up on today's show...
Show some respect. Expensive TV series The Crown is approaching along with a right royal top five.
And more artificial intelligence at cinema and all-star drama Nocturnal Animals.
Nocturnal Animals, Mark, we will be getting to that very soon. I just want to jump in on that point and say that's one of the best movies I've seen for a while. You need to approach it with caution, bear in mind, but it is one of the best movies happening at the moment.
I'll take your Nocturnal Animals and I'll raise you The Crown, which we'll be talking about later too.
We will. Before we get to that though, let's talk about some other things that are going on at cinemas right about now. The War on Everyone opened at cinemas last Thursday. Have you heard about this?
No, I haven't.
It's about corrupt cops in New Mexico. It's a little bit like Breaking Bad Lieutenants, I think. It's got Alexander Skarsgård and Michael Penner, who are blokes that, if you've seen any movies or TV shows with them in, you'll probably be very interested. They're cool actors. War on Everyone is out. It's from the guy who gave us The Guard and Calvary, which, again, if those names mean anything to you,
yeah,
I dare say
films, yeah.
You are already racing out to go check out War on Everyone, which I believe would be pretty intense, though. Pretty intense and graphic, and there'll be a lot of language in this. Also at cinemas, Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them. Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them. You gave us a great preview of this on the show last week, Mark. TheBigPictureWebsite.com is where you can find those details. And for anyone who doesn't actually know, this is the latest in J.K. Rowling's Harry Potter universe, but it's a prequel of sorts set in America. I reckon you expect 1.2 billion sequels to come out very soon.
Yes, and I actually saw it, and thumbs up from me.
Is it good fun?
It's brilliant.
All right, then. Thumbs up from Mark.
Okay, well, speaking of TV, I can't really go as far as thumbs up this week, but this is more in the nature of a community service announcement. The 30th anniversary of the awards show, The Arias, will be back on TV. That's all I can really say.
Right. You mean it's celebrating its 30th?
Its 30th year on TV.
Is it a recap of the 30 years?
No, it's just we're doing it for the 30th time.
Gotcha.
Okay,
yes.
So The Arias back on Channel 10. Look, if you're really into that, then you'll find them on 23rd of November at 7:30 p.m. broadcasting into your home. Also coming up this week, Monday, 21st of November, 7:30 p.m. If you've been following, like many Australian households, the X Factor, well, the final. Don't miss your moment. Plan your evening around it. As the gap narrows for the remaining hopefuls who've set their sights on that elusive music contract, well, don't forget to vote for your favourite. You'll do it this week, 7:30 p.m. on Monday for the X Factor final.
Mark, we are very soon going to be talking about The Crown, a new TV show. That's going to be our first review this week on The Big Picture. Before we get there, though, here's some entertainment news that actually strikes me as a bit of, I can't believe it's taken this long for this to actually be a thing. Kanye West, that's right, the rapper and like husband of Kim Kardashian and all kinds of other things.
Mega ego.
Just Kanye West. He is going to have a movie made about his life. And what's more, he's working on it with Will Ferrell, the comedian. And what's more, he wants Will Ferrell to play him, Kanye West.
What?
Kanye West wants Will Ferrell to play him on screen.
Does he want his own life to be a joke? There's so many layers to this. I don't even understand.
There's
what's
so
going
many layers
on
to Kanye West as well. But apparently, everything I've just told you is true.
Am I right in suggesting that Kanye West is an African-American?
You are right in suggesting that.
And
Will
Ferrell
is not.
Is not.
No. But the magic of acting, Mark. The magic of acting. Kanye West biopic. Expect that in the future.
Okay. A comedy coming to you soon. Even if it's not. Right. Well, look, in other entertainment news, in light of the election news this week, Dwayne The Rock Johnson says he's entertaining the idea of running for the White House.
So, what?
Just stop for a second. Yes, I think everybody just jumped the tracks on that one. Dwayne The Rock Johnson believes that he would make a good president. And who can argue with him now that Donald Trump is?
It seems like every week now for the rest of time, or at least during Donald Trump's presidency, there's probably going to be an announcement like this from somebody somewhere at some point saying, oh, actually, you've inspired me, Donald. I think even I could run for president.
Well, actually, particularly like The Rock's quote as he's actually releasing this press statement.
Oh, yes.
I love my country. I'm extremely patriotic. And I also feel, especially now, leadership is so important. Great leadership is so important. Respected leadership is so important right about now.
Let's move on swiftly, Mark. We are almost at What Your Kids Are Watching, our first review segment for this week. Before we get there, though, another review that's coming up a little bit later on the show is a new film called Morgan at Cinemas that's about artificial intelligence. So here is a true or false challenge based on the 2001 film AI, Artificial Intelligence.
Which is one of my favorite films, and I always get canned for this, but I think it's a really good film.
Yes, you think it's a very good film, but we'll get to that in a few moments' time. Haley Joel Osment was the little star of that film. True or false, did he not blink once while playing the young child android David in AI? So true or false, did he not blink once on screen during the entirety of AI, the 2001 film?
I'm just texting my wife if she can rewatch the film quickly whilst I review The Crown.
That's called cheating.
Okay. No, it's called marriage.
But we will get to true or false after we talk about this. The British monarchy is arguably the most respected in the world today, largely due to the efforts of one woman, Queen Elizabeth II. It's no surprise then that her life has become the focus of a new Netflix TV drama called, appropriately, The Crown. Queen Elizabeth knows better than anyone how heavy a crown can be. She's both the longest living and the longest reigning British monarch. And since she ascended the throne in 1952, she's also risen to become one of the world's most popular and public Christians.
And one has to ask oneself, what is the purpose of the crown? What is the purpose of the monarchy? The decision is yours to make.
You've taken my career from me. You've taken my home. You've taken my name. What kind of marriage is this? What kind of family? Are you my wife or my queen?
I'm both.
I want to be married to my wife.
I am both, and a strong man will be able to kneel to both.
I will not kneel before my wife.
But your wife is not asking you to.
But my queen commands me.
Yes.
I beg you, make an exception for me.
No.
Now, Mark, by all accounts, The Crown is lavish. Are you surprised it wasn't just trotted out on the BBC then?
Oh, look, I'm surprised that this wasn't a BBC production, but it's got all the hallmarks of a BBC production. It's incredibly accurate and well realised on screen. The production company Left Bank Pictures, which put this together for Netflix, spent £100 million on basically producing these 10 hours. And you just know it. From the moment you see episode one right up until the coronation to the palaces and everything. It's incredible the detail they've gone into this. So, look, I think it's fantastic. In case you're not understanding what we're talking about, The Crown is basically following the life of Queen Elizabeth II, or Lilibet, as she's known to her
as
friends.
As you like to call her.
As she's known to her friends. Not me, personally. I don't know Mom that well.
But Mom will suffice, yes.
But basically from her early 20s, just before she actually, her father dies and she becomes queen. There's no spoiler in that. I think it's history. We're on the record. And then and it follows through, you know, in terms of the great tumults of her life. And one season has been done. Another season's coming. It is just an incredible production, well worth looking at.
We've slotted it into our What Your Kids Are Watching short segment for this week. So I think a fair question is, why would the kids be watching this? And let's just spread that out a little bit further. Why would you and your family watch it? Because it sounds like you're a big fan of this. So why would you be suggesting other parents might watch this with their kids?
So I feel like this has got everything for a family in it. I mean, to begin with, it passes the first basic family definition of, is this safe watching for my kids? Okay, so there's apart from one swear word, which actually earns it an MA15 plus.
I was just about
rating.
To point out, isn't it rated MA15
plus?
It's
rated MA15 plus for one word used in the episode one, and in context, I can even understand why it happens. But look, you know, you could almost, just when the king starts doing limericks, okay, parents, just put the volume down for a second, then the whole series is fine after that. You're right. But look, the reason why it's good is because it is actually the romance that I think, you know, older teens might be keen to watch, particularly daughters and things like that, or even the movement of powerful figures on stage and epic drama that maybe older boys would be interested in watching. And yet it's real life, okay? It's historically accurate. It's about the struggle of someone to try and work out whether or not they actually have a place in this world as a Christian and in power, you know? And so it's just fabulous watching, I think, for the family to talk and think through.
So you just mentioned there various members of your family and what they might get out of it. But what about as a whole, do you reckon? Like, is there a big payoff for sitting down as the family gathering around the crown?
Yeah, I feel so. Look, I don't. The Queen, Elizabeth II, is an incredibly humble character and has always been so. And she comes across quite strongly as a humble character within this series as well. But one thing that she's absolutely adamant on is that she answers to God before she answers to her family or to her husband or to the people of England itself, you know, or the empire.
And that's clear in this series.
Episode after episode, you see this growing conviction in her that she must honor God first.
You're surprised it's in there to that degree? Because often with real life characters who do have strong Christian convictions, yeah, it can be watered down a little bit. This sounds like they really go for it.
I think to some degree, they're sitting back and looking at it. So it's almost as if, you know, it's not like the series is just happily supporting that position all the way along. Sometimes Elizabeth, you know, I guess to secularize, might look a little strange because she's saying, no, this is not about my husband and me. This is about what God would want of me in this situation. And yet I think as Christians, that's a fantastic example. So that's one of the reasons why I think it's actually really worth watching. You know, she's been allowed to be a prominent Christian and she's worked that out through wedding vows, through decisions that she makes on screen. You'll see her constantly weighing this. And I guess for us, it reminds us of the Christian responsibility of being faithful in all our roles, not just to those who are closest to us or at church, but openly and in the public sphere. She's done it for 80 plus years. And to be honest, I think it's a wonderful commendation watching this series to see what one Christian has done.
Okay, all 10 one-hour episodes of The Crown are now available for your streaming delight via Netflix. And if you like that, a second season is on the way. As Mark mentioned, it is rated MA15+ it says for strong, coarse language, but that seems to be just to one certain dirty limerick in episode one. Otherwise, it's quite passable from there.
All the way through.
Mate, before we get on to the rest of the show, before you talked about The Crown even, I raised a true or false statement challenge, and it goes like this. Haley Joel as Osment, the actor, did not blink once on screen while playing the young child android David in AI Artificial Intelligence from 2001, true or false?
Well, personally, I believe that Haley Joel Osment actually is an android, so I don't think he did blink.
You are indeed correct, not about him being an android, but about the fact, yes, he did not blink once on screen, obviously, to get the robotic effect, which is very different to me when I was in the audience watching AI, where I distinctly remember falling asleep, I think at last count, 3 times, and the film still didn't end whenever I would wake up. It was still going, so I went back to sleep.
I should actually lend you my extended edition so that you can possibly see whether or not that's still true.
Or so I could get a good night's sleep.
Why not?
Coming up on the show, Mark?
Well, coming up now, we've got a real-life doctor tells us how he works out the value of life and the value of vegetables as well. And the sci-fi thriller on New Life, Morgan. Welcome back to The Big Picture.
Coming up soon, we'll be taking a look at the new sci-fi thriller Morgan, which is a film about the creation of life in a computer lab and whether or not it deserves to have its plug pulled. But before we get there, we thought we'd get an expert to weigh in on this topic. Dr. Sam Chan is one of those double doctorate kind of guys. So he's, for one, a medical practitioner who regularly deals with life and death issues, and he has also lectured in ethics at the Sydney Missionary Bible College. So we thought this week for Press Record, we'd send Mark off to grill him on a tough, tough question. What is life?
Sam, thanks very much for giving us some time today. Look, I understand you're a doctor. Before we get into the ethical questions, can I just check your credentials?
Sure.
Okay, so do I really need to eat my vegetables?
You know, it's funny. I've got boys and they love their vegetables because the incentive we tell them, if you eat your vegetables, it will make you poo. And that is what gets them so excited. So they don't care about their health benefits. They just want to know what the toilet benefits are.
And what's the cure for the common cold?
The cure for the common cold apparently is washing your hands. So they did this study where they got people to kiss babies that were sick and another group of people to hug babies that were sick. The huggers caught the cold, not the kissers. It's from touching surfaces and people. That's how we get sick. So it's nothing exciting, unfortunately. We want a silver bullet, some secret cure out there, but it's everything your mother told you to do.
Well, let's see if we can find some silver bullets when it comes to ethical problems. We've been talking about a topic that Hollywood regularly considers, especially in science fiction: what qualifies as life? Now, you're a doctor, you deal with life and death. Does the medical profession have a nifty definition of what qualifies for life?
Well, it just comes down to your body's vital signs. Is your heart beating? Are you able to breathe spontaneously? Is your brain working? And this gets more complicated the more complicated medicine gets, because now medicine can keep your heart and your lungs breathing and beating artificially. So now it all comes down to brain death. And there's some criteria for brain death, but it all comes down to basic reflexes. Are your basic brainstem reflexes still working? And if they're not, you're dead.
Well, we're in trouble when we come to science fiction, though, aren't we? Because no lungs, maybe in a robot, no real need to have circulation or movement, but evidence of higher brain function, probably?
Well, yeah, this takes us to a richer definition of life, because medicine gives us a very narrow definition of life. You know, what do my body parts do? But as we know, somehow we are more than the sum of our body parts. When my boy was so young, he was only 2 or 3, he asked me, "Dad, how does my leg move?" And I said to him, "Well, your brain tells your leg to move." And then he says to me, "Well, how do I tell my brain to tell my leg to move?" And I said to him, "Toby, you have stumbled upon the mind-body duality problem." This is what philosophers have struggled with all along, that somehow, how do we communicate with our body what to do? There must be some part of me that seems to be immaterial, and it's the mind-body duality problem, which is what robots are coming to as well. In them is a mind, but it's not material. It's something bigger than the sum of their parts.
Now, you've been a lecturer in ethics at Sydney Missionary Bible College, am I right?
Yes, yes.
So this question of life and what it is, does that impinge on much in the discussion?
Oh, my goodness. Well, obviously, the big one is, when does life begin? And if you try to use a narrow definition, you're guilty of what's called question begging, where you've assumed the truth of your argument before you've even started. So people try one or two, maybe three moves. One is, life begins when we look a certain way. So maybe we have a certain number of cells, or maybe our cells have started differentiating, so that makes it day 14. But then we would come back and say, well, when do looks come into it? Well, because I went to my high school reunion and we all looked completely different from what we did 20 years ago, yet we are the same person. So somehow it's arbitrary what you define as looks. Why should we make eyebrows or earlobes the definition of when life begins? So why should it be the trilaminar gastrulation streak formation at day 14? Why couldn't it be something else at day 2 or day 1? So then people go for, if it's not looks, it's function. When you do something, that's when life begins. So maybe when you achieve independent thought, maybe when you can activate self-motivated body movement, maybe when you can sustain life by yourself. But the problem with that is, there are many times in our life when that's not happening and we're still alive. Like if I'm under an anesthetic, I'm not doing those things. Or if I'm asleep, I'm not doing those things. Or when I'm in front of the TV, my wife would say, "Hey, you're not doing any of those things. You're not doing rational thought. You're not doing self-motivated movement." And when she tells me to take out the garbage, something, I can't hear her. I have selective deafness and selective unconsciousness. By definition, I'll be dead. So somehow it's not what I look like. It's not what I do. So that's where Christian ethicists will say, how about it's just we are. We are alive. Human beings rather than human doings. Life begins when you just are, when you're conceived.
Well, that's tricky too, though, because I like you telling us that there's a Christian definition that ethicists would like to work with, but how do you decide when someone is?
Well, when do we define a human anyway? So usually it's when you have your full set of chromosomes, when you have your full set of DNA, and that usually happens at conception. And anything else would seem to be an arbitrary thing. So the closest I got into a fight with my wife was she once gave me a sandwich to eat. I ate a few bites, decided, I've changed my mind, I don't want it, I put it in the bin. Then a little while later, I changed my mind, you know what, I am hungry, I want that sandwich. So I went through the bin and pulled out the sandwich, and my wife says, "You can't eat that." I said, "Why not? Like, it's the same sandwich, whether it's been in the bin or out of the bin, and it's the same with human life. We are the same whether we're in the womb or out the womb. It's an arbitrary definition of location or form or function. It's called a continuity of purpose. good. That's how we are the same person we were yesterday and tomorrow. Even though our cells are different, we're doing different things, but somehow there's a continuity of identity and a continuity of personhood.
It's probably the sort of science fiction story you've never heard of. A team of scientists invent life and then wonder whether or not what they've created is really alive. Just joking, Mark. It's actually one of the earliest science fiction themes in existence. Come on, everyone's heard of this. Especially ever since author Mary Shelley wondered whether Frankenstein was going to be a good boy or a bad one. This week, that old chestnut is back in the form of Morgan, which is our first Now Showing review for this week. It's a science fiction thriller starring Kate Mara, Paul Giamatti, and Jennifer Jason Leigh about a team of scientists who set out to create a new form of life and wonder if they've managed to build an innocent or a monster.
You feeling a little sad, Morgan?
Yes.
Do you like it here?
Yes.
What do you like about it?
I like my friends.
Do you think they treat you like a friend?
I mean, you think it's normal for friends to lock each other in cages?
What would you do if I recommended that you should not be allowed to leave this room? What if I recommended that you be terminated?
We should end this.
Answer me! What would you do?
So Kate Mara stars as Lee Weathers, a corporate risk management consultant who's called into this remote scientific environment facility to decide whether or not to terminate an artificially created being.
Terminate.
Let's not get there yet.
Please keep going.
So anyway, Morgan, who's this sort of artificial being, Anya Taylor-Joy plays her, was certainly built from human building blocks. She's basically been sort of like a human egg and, you know, the whole normal process. But what they've done is they've injected nanotechnology, the earliest stage, and allowed it to integrate into the host. And now Lee has to decide if this is a human being or a robot, real life or artificial or something else altogether too dangerous to let to live. Mm. You know, and so the tests begin.
Mark, there are lots of artificial intelligence style movies.
No.
Lots.
Yeah, there are lots.
Lots. So what approach does Morgan take? Does it attempt to be different?
No, let's be clear. This is the something goes wrong category.
Right. Okay. Right.
To be very straightforward.
So something entirely different. Like, yeah. Oh, no, something goes wrong.
It's not like, you know, Lee, the investigator, turns up and goes, yep, no, that's human.
Shortest movie ever.
Off we go. Thanks very much, everyone. Can somebody, you know, comp my parking? I'll be gone. No. This is similar to Ex Machina, though, to be honest.
Was that last year or this year?
2 years back. The Ex Machina is like an, if you haven't seen that film, basically it's the same idea. Life is being created. Can we evaluate? Did we really succeed? Is this really life? And it's the same sort of question. In essence, this is actually kind of a bit like Blade Runner too, okay? The whole idea of, evaluating and almost capturing something if it goes wrong. So this is definitely, in some senses, I've got to warn, Morgan is something of a horror film as well, okay? Because it really is veer kind of suddenly and violently into the stabby, stabby moments. Okay, so, you know, be warned.
I think we can guess the answer to this, but I'll still ask this question anyway. How well do the humans go as creators?
Well, I'm glad you asked.
Yeah, okay.
Let's begin by saying that we make the classic error, what we refer to as the anthropomorphic error.
Okay, whoa, what?
Which basically you look at a toaster and you say, this toaster looks a lot like me, so therefore it'll behave like me. Okay, you know, anything that looks human should behave human.
You do look like a toaster.
I know, thank you. I'm working out. If I'm not working out well, that's what my wife would say. But anyway, okay. If you take a creature and you create it in a lab and you design it to be a weapon, it always seems to surprise me that scientists go, this thing is behaving like a weapon. Okay, so that would be the shock of the film.
For example, didn't they see the Age of Ultron, that Avengers sequel, just a few years ago? Don't some of these scientists watch movies? Like, we watch movies and you see how it turns out. Or didn't they read Frankenstein? Like, what? Why are they so surprised?
Everyone is hoping that they'll have that breakthrough moment. So, in essence, Morgan is kind of like that too. The scientists in the film are going, can we finally push the boundaries whereby which we will make our creation that much more like us? And they decide that the best way to actually make their creation that much more like us is to introduce into a highly powered technical weapon the idea of emotions. So, as if all emotions would help. Okay, so.
So, Mark, to quote a very favourite film of yours, Almost Famous, Morgan sounds like a real think piece, or at least aiming to be a real think piece. So where does it end up? I think I'm hearing through what you're saying that you weren't much of a fan of it. Is that true?
Yeah.
And in light of all that, still, is it a think piece? Is it a think piece?
Look, it is a thinking person's film, and it has a sort of a limited release. You'll find it in sort of the Dendies and other sort of independent films, film showing places. But look, it is... like most science fiction design is designed to actually set up a context so you can ask a moral question and the audience can consider it. In this case, the question is, can something that is fundamentally bent be straightened? I mean, that is the idea behind Morgan. If something has been designed a certain way, can it be anything other than what it is? And I think that's a great question for us to ask as Christians. Morgan is actually designed to be a killer. Okay,
to be a killer.
Yeah, to be a killer. So giving her emotions and awareness of her programs and her problems and all that sort of stuff doesn't actually solve those problems.
Right.
Awareness doesn't help. She's got a problem that is, in fact, actually integral to who she is. Now, as Christians, we would go, penny drop moment, because we know this one. Jesus said 2,000 years ago that the problem with humanity is not actually the things on the outside, what they're saying, what they're doing, but it's actually the heart. And if you can't deal with the heart issue itself, you're never going to be able to deal ultimately with humanity's problem. And likewise, it's the same thing that comes out with Morgan. Ultimately, if you can't deal with what is in the core of Morgan, you're not going to be able to deal with her behavior or anything else like that. She's not going to be managed. Look, the film takes some other strange turns towards the end. I don't think it's terribly well constructed. To be honest, there are better films out there for discovering life and thinking about the implications. But, you know, if you've seen them all, maybe you want to add this one to the list.
That's always the best recommendation you want from people. If you've seen everything else, maybe you might want to check out Morgan, which is rated MA-15+ for strong violence. It does star Kate Mara, Anna Taylor-Joy, Paul Giamatti, and Jennifer Jason Leigh. And a very thought-provoking lasagna, according to Mark.
It's incredibly well acted, that lasagna.
Look out for it. You might have to go searching for it because it is on limited release. It came out last Thursday, November 17th.
Coming up, we've got a trip back to the musical 80s and another new Amy Adams movie that couldn't be more different than Alien Invasion Arrival.
Welcome back to the show.
Every now and then, we love to dig back into the back catalogue of musical movies to spread a little joy to our much-loved audience. And what could be more joyous than this conversation starter? The reason why I refer to this as a conversation starter is exactly what Jack Black calls it in the musical must-see High Fidelity. Okay, so Jack Black, you know, is a comedian that's made a certain sort of career out of being raw and cutting through. But interestingly, in the film, he has this moment with John Cusack, who stars as Rob, the sort of record store owner and compulsive list maker. When Rob is down in the dumps, and Jack Black's character makes a mixtape for Monday mornings, a Monday morning mixtape, which basically says, you know, you've got every reason to be happy. And he includes Katrina and the Waves on that as the opening song. And I figured that was a nice thing to say. It's almost the beginning of our week, so you've got every reason to be happy. Enjoy the morning buzz. Have you noticed how many movies turn up at our cinemas on a regular basis? I mean, how many of them are just out there?
I have noticed on a few occasions, Mark.
So many
every week.
All the time.
How do we stay in the job?
When I tell my friends, oh, I have to go see more movies this week.
Oh, woe is you, Mark.
I know, I get very little sympathy, strangely.
Yeah, I know. But it helps keep us in the job because there's more for us to talk about.
Among all of them, American actress Amy Adams is starring in two of the latest releases, if that wasn't enough this week. Far from the sci-fi universe of Arrival, Adam's other movie, Nocturnal Animals, is an intense, gripping journey into losing the one you love.
Edward? Hi.
Oh, Susan.
Hi. Good to see you.
You look beautiful, as always. Do you know that you were my first crush?
You were my first crush, too. Don't do this. He's too weak for you. The things you love about him now are the things you'll hate. To be this person that you thought I was.
When you love someone, you have to be careful with it. You might never get it again.
So, you're a science fiction fan, you've seen Amy Adams in Arrival, you go, hey, I'm off to see Nocturnal Animals. Is that how it works, Ben?
It could work like that, Mark. They are much different beasts, dare I say.
Oh, so
much
a bit of a warning straight
different
up front.
Beasts. Yes, this has nothing to do with sci-fi, everything to do with intense relationship drama and thriller. A big word of warning from the start. In the opening credits of this film, opening titles of this film, there's a lot of nudity on display. And then throughout the film, there's some really intense blasts of violence at various points. I'm getting that out of the way early because what I'm about to say about Nocturnal Animals is largely positive, actually pretty much extraordinarily positive. It's one of the best movies I've seen this year.
So we want to be clear, these tools have been used in the storytelling. If you're sensitive to that sort of stuff, you should be aware of that, or you don't want to take people who might be sensitive.
Yeah, that's right. If sensitive to those sort of things from the outset, you might not want to go. But this film is about the beautiful and grotesque in life, and I think there's a lot of context and a lot of explanation for why some of these things are going on in screen in front of us. Amy Adams is playing a woman called Susan. She's a fancy art dealer in LA with a life she's really quite miserable in. She's married to the actor in the film. He's played by Armie Hammer. You know that guy?
Armie Hammer
from Social Network. Married to him, but she's miserable. She used to be married to a guy called Edward, who's played by Jake Gyllenhaal, who's just written a book which he delivers to her, and that kind of kickstarts the rest of the film.
Now, I understand, actually, someone sort of dropped the plot hint, that basically Amy Adams spends an entire segment of the film basically reading a book.
Yeah, see a lot of Amy Adams reading a book.
Thrilling, yes. As film can go.
The new thriller. See, Amy Adams, read a book.
That turns page. New chapter.
She does, and she does turn it very well. Sometimes she's lying in bed reading, sometimes she's sitting up. It's a whole variety of places you can read a book. Wow. But one of the best parts of Nocturnal Animals is this idea of, not Amy Adams reading, but the story that she's reading. So it's written by this character she used to be married to, but the story plays out within the movie itself. So you almost get Amy Adams imagining what's on the page, the story that unfolds. And what unfolds is the story of Tony, who's also played by Jake Gyllenhaal, and something that happens to him in kind of Nowheresville, Middle America, in the middle of the night with his wife and daughter, which is one of the most intense scenes I've seen on screen this year. So, so chilling, where they get bailed out by a bunch of just yobbos on the highway. And this nightmarish scenario that plays out from there is the book that Amy Adams is reading. But one of the best things about Nocturnal Animals, Mark, I found, is that the story that she's reading about has a lot to do with what happened with her and her husband, Edward, who's written this book. And effectively what you come to discover is what he's written in this book is basically a representation of how he felt going through the disintegration of their marriage. But it's represented in this, it could have been a separate movie in and of itself, the story of Tony and what happens to his family. But I found it amazingly powerful as the film went along. And the director and writer of this, Tom Ford, deserves huge commendations for being able to bring all these elements together, tell a story in a story that says something about the life of this main character that Amy Adams is playing, but do it in such a provocative and memorable way.
Wow, sounds really complex but rewarding.
Yeah.
But as I understand it, you're basically saying there's a dark side of marriage being unpacked on the screen.
Yeah.
What does it leave the audience with?
There is, Mark, and particularly when you first meet Susan, Amy Adams' character, and she's just so miserable in this life that she expected to be really good. And on a variety of occasions, she talks about how she was married to this other guy, she ran off, married this other dude, and how life just hasn't really worked out, and she was hoping it would, but it's just basically meaningless and empty. And then you get this other story that her husband's written kind of about their marriage, and so you learn a lot more about what the impact on him, and you get told a lot throughout the film about how weak and a man he was. But in contrast to, I think, a lot of other movies and even sort of a lot of messages we get through culture at the moment, the character that that Jake Gyllenhaal is playing in this film, he's not torn down. He's not the butt of jokes. He's not the guy who we're meant to sneer at. Instead, he effectively becomes the hero across the film. Nocturnal Animals, amazingly, heads towards a point that is so different to other films. And this is one of the reasons I'm really big on Nocturnal Animals, is that it actually upholds marriage and love in a way that I think few other films have done in recent times.
A way you can get behind is
in a way you can get behind, in a way that says that, like, true love is true love. It can be tough. It can be difficult to do, but you know, like a part of the New Testament, like 1 Corinthians 7, that talks about working on your marriage and go towards reconciliation. Don't go apart. Come back together. It'll be difficult. You've got to go through all situations, but really dig down into this, because if you throw it away, if you destroy this bond that you have, particularly in marriage, like, the destruction that can come from it is not the kind of pot of gold at the end of the rainbow or grass is always greener picture that we get from so many other stories. That's why I'm really big on Nocturnal Animals. Again, word of warning, there's some intense stuff in this film that, you know, people will be shocked and turned off by. But the message is incredible about enforcing how tough love can be, but how rewarding it is and the destruction you can cause when you let it go.
Oh, wow. And you'd see it again?
I would definitely see it again.
Wow, maybe we can go together.
Mate, it's
if it's so too depressing, good. We could always play Katrina and the Waves afterwards.
We could do that.
Okay. Amy Adams and Jake Gyllenhaal and Michael Shannon star in Nocturnal Animals. It's rated MA15+ for strong themes and nudity. We've warned you about that. It's now showing along with excellent Arrival, which is also another great one. It's the Amy Adams Fest. Choose your Amy Adams adventure here.
Coming up on the show, a right royal top five. Hey, welcome back to the show.
Now, we want to tell you about your opportunity to construct a show. You enjoy listening to The Big Picture? Be part of it, because we have The Eternals. It's basically our film award, our gift to you, the opportunity for you to weigh in and say what you liked in film and television each year. Oh, sorry, not each year, this year. It's the inaugural year. So if you go to thebigpicturewebsite.com, that's thebigpicturewebsite.com, or actually go to the homepage of Hope 103.2, they've got a link there. Go and have a look and see how you can vote on The Eternals. And we'll be telling people on December 18 what films you liked, like in categories like who would you send a box of chocolates to as the best actress for the year?
Is that the awards we're coming
That's
up with?
Actually, boxes the of award. Chocolates. Who would you like to send a box of chocolates to as your best actress for the year?
We spared no expense. I reckon I just went on before the break about how good Nocturnal Animals was. I thought Amy Adams was great in that. I think she was even better than Arrival, so she might even get two votes from me. Can we do that?
Well, you can vote once.
Okay, then
you just need to find somebody else's computer to vote a second.
Then I will be trying to choose between Arrival and Nocturnal Animals for Amy Adams.
Or maybe you liked Maggie Smith and Lady in the Van, or Emily Blunt and The Girl on the Train, or Kate Beckinsale in Love and Friendship, or Kate Beckinsale in Blood Wars.
Oh, the Underworld sequel that's coming up in a few weeks' time.
Who knows?
That's probably not going to get any votes.
Okay, but that said, why don't you get along to thebigpicturewebsite.com, vote for The Eternals, and on December 18, we'll give you the results.
Well, Mark, right at the start of the show, and we have come to the end of the show, but before we conclude everything, right at the start of the show, you were talking about The Crown, and so we thought this week for Top 5, what better thing to do than to do a Right Royal Top 5? So, Mark, coming in at a respectable number 5.
5.
2001's The Princess Diaries. This is one for the little ladies.
Yeah.
The little ladies out there, Anne Hathaway.
We're all staying up late on a Sunday night.
I know,
or podcasting, it's more likely.
That's right. Just waiting to for the week when we finally mentioned The Princess Diaries from 2001. And here it is. Anne Hathaway lived out what I hear is a little girl's fantasy, Mark, to be a princess. This was a Disney movie that turned into real life up on screen, apart from it was still a Disney movie and it wasn't really real life. But Anne Hathaway is playing a teenager who all of a sudden discovers, hey presto, you're actually the heir to the throne in some fantasy kingdom of Genovia.
Yes.
Genovia. She's a normal girl who goes on to take on the throne. And she's sort of being, isn't she being instructed in the ways of thronely life by her grandmother, who's the queen, played by none other than Disney monarch Julie Andrews.
Did you like Princess Diaries 1 or 2 better?
Well, Mark, if I had to choose between them, it's not often when I do. If I did have to choose between them.
Like, I often play them back to back because I can't.
And I have been confronted by this question on many occasions, Mark. Look, I like them both for different reasons, but equal ones.
I like the one where they create life and they're not sure if it should have a conscience.
I'm going to move on to number 4.
4.
King and I from 1956.
If only for the dance scene.
Shall we dance? Dun, dun, dun.
Oh.
Da, da,
da. No, I was going to say. I was going to say, if only for my wife Amy, who's a massive fan of King and I. I still haven't seen King and I.
What? Which with Yul Brynner?
With Yul Brynner and Deborah Carr from 1956. I think I said 1959. 1956. No, I've still not seen it. I've got a copy at home. I've been listening to Amy's recommendation and watching it. I do listen to my wife, you can tell.
Leave plenty of room when you do watch it in the lounge room so you can dance because this is compulsive dancing.
She talks up the dances and the songs and that kind of thing. So I still haven't been persuaded yet, but maybe I'll get there. So I'm putting this on the list mainly for my wife. As most people would know, this is a famous, very popular musical by Rodgers and Hammerstein, but it's actually based on a novel, which in turn was based on a memoir of a real school teacher who worked with the King of Siam back in the 1860s.
Which we would know as Thailand today.
As you said, Yul Brynner and Deborah Carr star in it. It's a little bit like one of those different sides of the tracks and cultures story with music and singing and dancing and teaching kids. And then some truth bombs come the way of the King of Siam throughout the course of King and I, which at some point in human history, Mark, I reckon I might actually watch.
3.
But I have seen this, 2006, The Queen.
Oh, this is one of my favourite films. Like, if I had to do a top 50, it'd definitely be in it.
Really? Top 50?
Oh, for sure. I'd even go lower, but I didn't want to embarrass myself.
Wow, you are quite the royal watcher.
I am.
Helen Mirren, as everybody knows, was born to play Queen Elizabeth. She did a sterling job up on screen as the Queen. She won an Oscar for this, didn't she?
Yeah.
Yeah, of course she did. It's a candid and credible account of navigating the decline of that royal family's integrity and social standing, given it's set in kind of the aftermath of Princess Di's death and kind of the public response and also the internal response. It sounds a little bit like The Crown, I'm imagining, Mark, having not seen it, but given it gives you this intimate look behind the scenes of a public figure. I'm imagining what The Crown's doing early in life is what the Queen did kind of later in the Queen's life.
Actually, if you liked The Queen, you'll love the television series The Crown.
Righto.
Yeah. There you go.
Gets your thumbs up. Also gets some thumbs up from me because Michael Sheen was in this and I thought he was great as the government foil to the Queen as he was playing the real life Prime Minister Tony Blair. But I do not think that is anywhere near as right royal special as
2.
Getting the Aussie vote, 997's The Castle.
How is this in a...
Castle.
You're going to hang the whole thing on the fact that there's a castle in it.
Yep.
Why don't you make The Lord of the Rings one of the royal films?
We still have a number one choice.
Oh, sorry, you're right.
That may aim another... It's not going to be on that. Come on, Mark. I didn't bend the rules that much, but come on. It's a defining treatment of the great Australian dream to own your own home, your own castle, so you can be the king of your or queen of your own castle.
I see. Okay.
See what I'm keeping on trying to lean on here?
Keep pushing it.
That were everyday royalty... of family love and respect and nobility in their own suburbia.
Yeah.
And they did battle with other ruling factions, which were trying to seize their domain from them.
Okay, I would have agreed with you about 2 minutes ago if you just wanted to.
In the castle, seize their domain, other ruling factions,
okay.
The castle.
Doesn't one of them drive a Kingswood?
That if they didn't, they should have. Come on, man. I thought I was doing all right on that one.
Okay,
really?
Okay. At number two.
At number two.
Of all the royal films you could think of.
Of all the royal films. I can't believe you're so sneery about such little Aussie battlers, Australian legends.
What about Elizabeth?
What about Elizabeth? That's got an Australian link, sure, in star Kate Blanchett, but that's Iron Geoffrey Rush was in that as well. But sure, but it's nowhere near as epic and royal and memorable as The Castle, clearly, because it's at number two on the list, but not nearly as epic and royal and memorable as...
One.
Speaking of Australian links, and actually speaking of Geoffrey Rush, The King's Speech from 2010.
Okay.
Are you okay about
that?
You
redeemed yourself there.
And this also was produced by an Australian company who was pretty happy with themselves, I think, when they backed this horse, and then they did everything from win loads of Oscars to make a lot of money at the box office. This is a good little movie, a little bit like The Queen, I think, where you see royalty are people too. They're actually real people with real issues that they've got to come up against. And even if you're born into a position that you are required to handle, you might not be up to it, or you might not think that you're up to it, but you need a little help from your friends, or you need a little help from an Australian speech therapist who's living in London in the 1930s. This was set in the 1930s, in the shape of Lionel Logue, played by Geoffrey Rush, who went to help King George VI, played by Colin Firth in The King's Speech, who had some issues with his speech, which at some points is funny, usually is quite sad and very endearing, I think, as the film goes along. The relationship between them was great. Even if it was a little bit rich that an Australian was giving an English person lessons in diction and elocution, like that almost sounds like right for a comedy, which I know the film was kind of funny. But
it had its funny moments. But actually, I think you're really onto something when you start talking about those films that remind us that royal is not so much what you're born as, is what you hold up within your own life as an ideal.
Yeah, it's just like the
in
vibe
that
you
regard,
get.
Even you could be royal.
It's like the vibe you get from The Castle, Mark. That's exactly like the vibe you get from The Castle. Also, what The King's Speech reminded me of is there's a proverb in chapter 27 of Proverbs called "As iron sharpens iron, so one person sharpens another." It's kind of big in Christian circles, gets floated around a lot, and basically means that you need other people to help you kind of refine the edges, to work through things, to, as you forge ahead, other people can really assist you in what you're doing. And even if you are royalty, you can call out to others as iron sharpens iron to assist you in your public position, as was demonstrated in 2010's The King's Speech.
All right, Bertie.
Yes.
It's actually quite good fun.
Mother.
Shorten the humming each time. Mother.
Manufacturing. A district.
Another deep breath. And Jack and Jill.
Jack and Jill.
Went up the hill.
Went up the hill.
Now just sway.
Perfect. Will not permit us to...
Loosen the shoulders.
Ding dong bell. But he's in the well. Who put her in? Little Tommy Tim.
Number one on the Right Royal Top 5, Mark, The King's Speech from 2010.
Thumbs up. If you haven't seen it, you really should.
Yeah. Okay, that was this show. What's happening next week?
Truth or Dare? Teen thriller Nerve clicks into the dangers of online culture.
And a working class man versus the welfare system in I, Daniel Blake.
And plus, would you want fries with that?
Would you like fries with that? Maybe.
Okay, we're actually going to have the founder served up with a man who made McDonald's.
I won't be Ben McDonald that week. I'm going to be Ben McKechnie.
I will be Mark Hadley. See you then.
The Big Picture is a Bible Society Australia production, sharing the light of God's Word into every corner of your world.